Thank you, Mark. So following on from what Dr. Levine has just covered, as you heard, water is one of the largest commodities we bring in and out of a city. And of the infrastructure, we think of drinking water treatment works as being important, which of course they are. But the pipes in the ground represent at least 80% of most agencies' assets, if you like. So the dollar value is really the pipes in the ground. So I'm going to talk about the issues to do with the distribution systems, those pipes in the ground taking drinking water. And as an example, as you heard, some of these pipes have been in the ground for a long time, and cast iron particularly, but not only, ductile iron, cement line pipes do degrade, and we end up with these tubercles or tubercules-like growths of iron oxides associated with microbial growths inside pipes. So don't be revolted by that. You can still have good, clean water coming through these pipes, but this is what an old age pipe can look like, or does look like. So the pathogens of concern. Now, most of you have had some microbiological training, so I'll just quickly go over these, but clearly starting with the smallest guys, these are the human enteric viruses. So these are typically around about 20 to 80 nanometers in diameter, so they're very small particles, typically negatively charged. Then we go through to the bacteria, of course, and here we have a photograph of E. coli, typically about half a micron by one or two microns in length, more rod-shaped in this case. We, of course, have some coccoids morphology of bacteria. And the parasitic protozoa, particularly organisms like Cryptosporidium, but in this case we're looking at some Giardia cysts. So these are slightly more oval in shape, typically around about 16 to 18 long and about 12, 13 wide. So these are the sorts of pathogen particulates, if you like, that come from fecally contaminated water. Not just human sewage, but only human sewage, really, when we're talking about enteric viruses, because they just come from nearly always human fecal contamination. Of course, there are some exceptions to that rule. For example, hepatitis E virus coming from swine. But majority of the viruses are only coming from human fecal contamination, but these other two groups can also represent zoonoses, coming from animals to humans as well. So we're interested in the animal manures as well as the human septic seepage getting into our source waters. Now, we've designed systems, as you've heard from Dr. Levine, to handle most of these sorts of contaminants in the broad brush sense of things with our water filtration plants, be it from surface waters or from groundwater systems. But what we haven't really thought hard about are some of the shorter term, what I'm calling here, hazardous events, things that can go wrong. Like we have a large rain event, we get more contaminated water coming into a system, it may over-challenge the water filtration plant a little bit, and there may be breakthrough into the distribution network. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how we're looking at these hazardous events and what we might need to target to better manage for those sorts of hazardous events. And when we do this sort of systems analysis, we realize fairly quickly that our distribution systems are perhaps the more vulnerable. And in some ways, we've thought the distribution system, because perhaps it's been out of sight and the pipes in the ground and everyone feels comfortable, that that was under control. There's a realization now as our infrastructure is aging, and quite frankly, the water industry is underspending in maintaining that infrastructure, something like $20 billion a year are not being spent maintaining our current infrastructure, our pipes in the ground. So they are deteriorating. We're getting mains breaks and ruptures, and not necessarily being looked after as best as they could. So I'm going to talk a little bit about those issues and a little bit more about this quantitative microbial risk assessment. So if we look at a whole system and the sorts of... how did I manage to do that? If we look at the whole system, we can split it into the watershed, and the things that can go wrong in a surface watershed, of course, can be sewage outfalls failing and contaminated sewage going into that. There can be waterfowl in the water or by the water, and there can be rain-driven events from septic seepage from humans or from overland transport from animal production facilities. So these are the sorts of things that can introduce pathogens. In our reservoirs, we used to think of large reservoirs with 6 months or more storage capacity being just that. But in fact, they're stratified water bodies that can have short-circuiting. I'm an Australian, come from Sydney, and we have a very large reservoir there that's meant to have over 2 years mean residence time. But during a rain event, water can pass through that reservoir within about 8 days because it goes through preferential pathways. So that's what we refer to as short-circuiting. And of course, direct fecal contamination there. At treatment, we can have the breakthrough those filters, those sand filters with coagulation, sand filtration, and then disinfection, the conventional that you just heard about. There can be short duration periods potentially of breakthrough through those filters. And an extra high turbidity in the sense of surface waters can add more challenge to a water production facility. And in distribution, the sorts of things that may go wrong that you heard about are integrity losses. So these are things where there's mains breaks because of this aging infrastructure, we're getting more of those, and repairs are times when fecal contamination is a potential. But there are other issues of pressure loss that may cause water in a pressurized area around the pipe, in other words, it's saturated soil, potentially could flow back in under low pressure scenarios in the pipeline itself. So this is something else being considered. And my particular area of interest is on the slimes that grow along these pipe distribution systems, the biofilms and the interactions there. So all of this is what we use to estimate our risk, and this can be done in a qualitative sense, which is what the water industry typically does, or it can be done in a more quantitative way, in what we refer to as quantitative microbial risk assessment. I'll just quickly walk you through how we do this, but this is really a complement to epidemiology that Joan Brunkard is going to talk much more about, and what the Centers for Disease Control and Protection are monitoring and collecting over the years. So this is an alternative approach based on looking at pathogen numbers, and we refer to the particular pathogens we are interested in as reference pathogens, because we don't look at all, you know, the few hundred pathogens that may end up in water. It's just too many to look at, so we pick representatives of those viral, bacterial, and parasitic protozoa. Those are our reference pathogens. And then we also identify these hazardous events, where we look at the whole system itself. Next step is getting some sense of the exposure. So we have our source water, be it surface or ground, the distribution of pathogens that might be in that. And this is where we typically can measure pathogens directly. Otherwise, their concentrations are typically so low, we can't measure them elsewhere in the system. So we measure pathogen removal typically by surrogates, like how much particulate matter is removed during the sand filtration process. And in disinfection, for example, by the concentration and time that we challenge those organisms with the disinfectant, be it free chlorine or monochloramine, but typically it's free chlorine as the primary disinfection at the water filtration facility. Then it goes into distribution, as you heard, and here it could be subject to ingress and growth of organisms post-water treatment. And I'll talk much more about that shortly. Then a certain volume is ingested. So here we end up with a dose and a volume of water that gives you a total dose that you might have in a glass of water, statistically speaking, and then fitting a dose response model from epidemiologic studies and outbreak investigations, we have some idea for these reference pathogens what the probability of an illness and infection is. And from all that, we can then characterize the risk. So that's our quantitative microbial risk assessment approach, analogous to what's been done for 30 years for chemical risk assessment. But here, in some ways, there are some differences. We work with a smaller suite of pathogens to be representative of the organisms, and we actually work with real human dose response data rather than animal models, typically, or other approximations. But, there are always buts. So the microbial risk assessment is looking from source and trying to estimate the actual pathogen concentration in that dose. I've done that again. And don't forget, however, we have a host response at the other end. So not everyone's going to respond the same, particularly depending on their immunological status and a whole array of other host-related things. But looking at the overall uncertainty in our estimates, we typically have the highest uncertainty in estimating this environmental concentration rather than the dose response component. Nonetheless, there are other things we're becoming more aware of in doing quantitative microbial risk assessment, and that is secondary spread. Often pathogens can be spread person to person, of course, as well as through the fecal-oral route of exposure through drinking water. And it's important to take on board the ramifications of that for those pathogens that are secondary spread, because it obviously adds a higher health burden to the population. So we try to incorporate those in what we refer to as dynamic risk modeling, where it takes on board the immunity status and secondary spread of the population. But in summary, from all the work that has been done in quantitative microbial risk assessments, it's quite clear that hazardous events are the things that we need to now be looking out for. Most of our systems are very robust, that they manage water very well the vast majority of the time. But the question marks, and the only question marks, are what happens during these events. And based on some of the statistical modelling of what we think might be happening rather than reality, there are concerns. And the biggest concern actually comes in distribution systems. When we get an E. coli detect, what does that really represent? Is it fresh sewage contamination? Is it a misidentification in the laboratory? Is it laboratory contamination? There are a whole array of potential issues here that would change the risk almost a millionfold in our estimated level of risk, depending on what that E. coli detect might mean. Okay. So another thing that is we've learned from doing this risk assessment, as Dr. Levine mentioned, most water monitoring is done at the end of the, what we call finished water, at the filtration plant. And there, we're basically below detection for pathogens. And if we run our statistical models, we need to be picking up very low levels of viruses to meet what we believe is a useful benchmark here, which is going for one or less than one infection per 10,000 people per annum. That has been a benchmark used by the US EPA in setting various cryptosporidium and other regulations in the past. And just translating that to what that means in virus concentration, less than really one virus in a million litres. We don't tend to sample those sorts of volumes of water. We sample 100 millilitres on a random sort of basis at finished waters and through the distribution network. So it really means there's little point in focusing on pathogens at that point. So we focus on fecal indicators. And our best so far fecal indicator, although it has many problems, is E. coli. So in the total coliform rule revisions, we're moving away from a maximum contaminant level for the group we refer to as total coliforms, which is the largest suite of organisms that are these gram-negative rods that ferment lactose in 48 hours to acid and contain a beta-galactosidase as an enzyme. We're moving away from the total coliform group to the more specific fecal indicator, E. coli, as our real measure of fecal contamination, but still keeping the total coliform group there as a, if you like, a trigger that something may be happening in the water. So I'd like now to spend more time in at the slime level. So when we move into pipes, as you saw from that introductory slide of mine, there is all the corrosion occurring, and a lot of that corrosion is actually microbially induced corrosion. And a fair number of those microbes, they're good guys. They're just naturally, like on our skin, they're part of the natural microbiota that, in this case, colonize our engineered distribution systems. And here you're looking at, in fact, a slime on a UPVC pipe. And it's black. It's black. Why? Because of their various iron oxides and sulfides that are generated causing these precipitates of iron oxides and sulfides. So this is actually a recycled water main, hence it's a little blacker than what you'd normally expect in a drinking water main. So this is non-potable recycled water. And if we look more closely at that, we can sort of picture that we've got this whole microbial community in three-dimensional space, which is largely hydrated gel. Most of the biofilm is actually extracellular polymeric substances, carbohydrates, proteins, extracellular DNA, in fact, and with cells interdispersed through this gel-like matrix. And we're really interested in some of these members of the gel because some of these are our mycobacterium, which avium complex, the non-tuberculous mycobacteria, as we often call them, the NTMs. These are organisms that are ubiquitous in the environment. What is their health significance? At the moment, we actually don't really know. But these are some of the members that colonize these biofilms. So we have two scenarios. We have fecal contamination, either breaking through our filtration barriers or breaking into our distribution network, introducing enteric pathogens. And so we can think of these as our anthraponoses. They're coming typically from sewage contamination, viruses, parasitic or enteric bacteria, and parasitic protozoa. So in addition to coming in through the pipe water, which we believe is a rare occurrence, there is actually another level of treatment. Because of those surfaces and slimes, we can end up with biofilm sorption of those introduced organisms. And basically, that's one area we're trying to model in to a higher degree right at the moment to get a sense of that. There are other things that happen, like gene exchange. Because of that higher density of bacterial organisms in that environment, there is actually exchange of genes like antibiotic resistance genes. It's now being demonstrated in distribution biofilms. And of course, none of that really matters unless they leave the biofilm and slough off or erode off the biofilm back into the bulk water of the drinking water supply. And the other class of pathogens which we're becoming more aware of, we heard a little bit about a question asked earlier about Legionella and a little bit about the mycobacteria. So some of these have members that are true opportunistic pathogens. And so these are organisms that can grow in theory, and in practice we see them, particularly in premise plumbing inside buildings where there is low residual chlorine. We see organisms like Legionella pneumophila, even serogroup 1, and in fact hospital distribution systems, I mean in premise of the hospital itself, are notorious for these organisms to colonize, along with the Mycobacterium avium complex and other non-tuberculous mycobacteria. In theory, and in practice, we measure by the polymerase chain reaction. Occasionally, people pick up Helicobacter pylori in these biofilms. I have a PhD student looking into the growth of these organisms, and in theory, they can grow in distribution systems. In practice, no one's ever demonstrated a viable organism in a distribution system, and indeed, whether that is a useful pathway, given person-to-person spread is thought to be the primary pathway in developed regions of the world, but maybe water is important in developing areas. And then there are protozoa like Naegleria fowleri that will grow in warm waters. In particular, this has been a problem down in Tucson and Arizona, where I come from in Australia. We have pipelines that go overland for hundreds of kilometres, and the water can get up to 30 degrees centigrade, and with low residual chlorine, these organisms will flourish. And so this is a concern also. And many of these saprinosas, as we call them, these organisms that can grow post-treatment, grow in association not only with the biofilms, but what these guys, the amoeba, are doing, they're feeding on the biofilms. And some of these bacteria have learnt to evade, if you like, the digestive processes of these grazing amoeba and grow within the amoeba and amplify. So I better race through the next lot. So it's summarising here. So we have data gaps from distribution systems in trying to better understand what are the health ramifications and how might we better control and manage these issues. So we have intrusions, as I've mentioned before. What does E. coli mean? We have the fate and transport within the distribution system, and I'll briefly talk a little bit more about that. And then we have the growth of these opportunistic bacterial pathogens in particular, Legionella-like organisms and our mycobacteria that are emerging issues of concern. And indeed, these are on this candidate contaminant list, as Audrey Levine mentioned earlier, the CCL3 list, as it's now just been recently released. Now, if we look at what we currently model distribution systems, which in a hydraulic sense is typically, if we think of water flowing through a pipe, we think of it as going along as a sort of a pulse of water or a unit of water moving through a pipe. So if there is introduction of contamination, we would think of that moving as a plug of contamination through the plumbing system. And indeed, EPA Net, which is a freeware available from the US EPA to model what's happening in your distribution systems, this is what is assumed, that a pulse comes in. Here we have a contaminant concentration, and downstream it will flow as plug flow, and so that pulse will stay pretty much as a pulse. In fact, this is not what quite happens. We get dispersion around that plug, and that dispersion occurs because of interactions with those surfaces, the biofilms, various turbulent factors going on, and differential mixing. And so we typically end up with some sort of spread. So contamination is not necessarily a tight little plug, but it may be spread over some considerable time. So that's the first point. And when we look at salts or viruses experimental demonstrations of this, we see them spreading out pretty much like this laminar flow estimation here. This is a very busy slide, and it's from the Water Village, but it's very similar to what's also happening in the National Homeland Security Research Center in EPA in Cincinnati, that water is coming through this facility. Whoops, I went again. Comes through this facility. They can spike in known organisms and then use an array of different commercially available instruments. And these are just shown a little bit better down here. So there are various sorts of instruments that can measure directly some sort of microbes, they believe. But in essence, none of these work absolutely. So it's really a combination of potential particulate size, microbial monitoring, along with physicochemical measuring like total organic carbon, the change in UV sorption, etc., that tell us that there's some change in the water quality, which can then trigger, in the case of the Guardian Blue, it triggers an automatic sampling device. In the case of Homeland Security, and you'll hear more about this later, there's an ultrafiltration device for sampling the water, taking up 100 litres or so and concentrating that water. So these are the ways that we're moving now towards looking at real-time monitoring and collecting of samples to verify what might be in that contaminated water. And these are being put around the country at various strategic locations in distribution networks based on model simulations of if there was contamination, where should we best place these devices, because they're expensive. The last part I want to really is talk a bit more about the biofilm and these opportunistic pathogens that grow within, or potentially. So one thing we're developing in the EPA is what we're calling a biofilm-like sampling device. So rather than relying on grab samples, which I think you've got the message now are highly unreliable for picking up short duration events, the online monitoring devices are moving towards a more secure system. Another option that we're looking at is planting out a device that basically acts like biofilm by sorbing microbes from the water onto iron oxide surfaces. I'll just jump through this, put it all up at a time. And also, that device it can be left in place. So if we think there's been an event, we can pull out this device and rapidly extract and by PCR screen for a range of different pathogens that might be and indicators that may be sorbed onto that surface to say, yes, indeed, it was a fecal contamination event. And yes, it is Cryptosporidium or human enteric viruses that we can pick up on the device. So it's an alternative to that large volume filtration that you'll hear about later. Another component is that we're trying to model mathematically what organisms will stick onto such a device or indeed stick onto biofilms in general through distribution. And this modeling has been done by a PhD student at the University of Cincinnati with me and Jim Uber. Basically, we've got the concentration in the bulk water of any pathogen is going to be driven by diffusion into the biofilm. And so it's a diffusional-driven model that we're trying to simulate what sort of concentrations would end up in biofilms given a certain concentration in the bulk water. When we run these sorts of models, once you've gone through quite a few miles of pipe, if you've had a contamination event of 10,000 viruses or more coming in, they will basically be sorbed up into the biofilm before it actually reaches the customer's tap because of this trapping into the biofilm. So the real question then is what comes off? Biofilm detachment. And we can simulate biofilm detachment in what we call annual reactors. In this case, these are little devices that have coupons. It's a bit hard to see, but this blue coating here is the coupon surface, simulating a pipe surface, and it's spinning in an annulus to give you the same shear as you get when water flows through a pipe going over a biofilm. So we can simulate different shears, and that's what's shown here by laminar flow, semi-laminar, and turbulent flow, measured by here the Reynolds number, and the amount of biofilm that comes off during those conditions. So we can get some way to model what might be coming off a biofilm. And the last part, sorry for the race through all this, the Trojan horse. This is another realization, if you like. So the more recent realizations have been the hazardous event and are we protective of those. Another one is these Trojan horses, like the amoeba, that allow the reproduction, if you like, of these intracellular obligate, in many cases, pathogens, like some of the Legionella, Mycobacteria, even Helicobacter, even E. coli 157 will grow inside amoeba. So we're interested in amoeba, and if you've had a chance now to look through here, you can see from this earlier work that amoeba are present in source waters, and they do make their way through various treatment barriers, ending up in filtered water. And so they can carry, in the form of a cyst, encapsulated in there, some of these opportunistic pathogens. And in the biofilms work I did with some colleagues in Sweden, we found quite high numbers of amoeba. This is in really quite cold, and AOC is a measure of assimilable organic carbon. It's a measure of how much carbon is in the water, which is, in essence, one of the growth components for biofilms to grow in a system. And this is a relatively low number. Typically in the US, the numbers are here around 100 or just under 100, thereabouts. So we get quite a number of amoeba growing, of course, feeding on the bacteria in the biofilms. And the concern here is which amoeba and are some of those likely to be hosts for these opportunistic pathogens. So with a postdoc who happens to be sitting in the audience here, I'll make her go red if I can, Helen Lauer and I and others at the EPA in Cincinnati are looking at particularly Legionella and the virulence of such organisms. So we have a conceptual model here we published in the Journal of Applied Microbiology this year. It's a bit hard to read the fine print, but in essence, we're looking at non-pathogenic Legionella and pathogenic Legionella. Let's just assume such beasts exist, with the color coding coming in there. So they come into the system, either found in the cyst or as free cells. They colonize in the biofilm environment, let's call it that, and they may then leave the biofilm in various forms, as free cells, associated with biofilm, associated with the cysts, or within here, or within the trophozoites. So Helen Lau is looking at the relative infectivity of these different formulations of Legionella using a mouse model, in fact, a lung colonization assay along with some cell line macrophages to get a sense of which form, and in fact, are all these forms infectious. And why that is important is that when biofilms detach, we might end up with clusters of Legionella of about 100 or so, which based on some modeling done with guinea pigs, looks like it's an infective dose. We're interested, of course, in is the residual chlorine that we maintain, and by EPA regulation from the total coliform rule, should be maintained in all distribution systems, is that free chlorine or combined chlorine, it's in the form of monochloramine, is it effective at killing, if you like, inactivating those organisms? Well, the quick answer is yes if they're planktonic, but no if they're associated within the biofilm and probably within the trophozoites and certainly in the amoeba cysts themselves, they are resistant. So this is ongoing work happening now to get a better sense of that. Here is just a bit more biofilm. And so another postdoc of mine published some years back these sort of relative numbers that biofilm increased the resistance by one or two orders of magnitude. So that's a 90 to 99% less effective disinfection, if you like, occurring here. Heating is often used, particularly in hospitals, to heat the system up to 80 degrees to inactivate the organisms. That's very effective, but not totally effective. We're still finding that if your system is well colonized, the organisms in the cyst, there will be a small fraction of those that will survive the system and then recolonize your system. And indeed, this is what hospitals around the world find. Whilst they can maintain a low number of Legionella, they have to maintain this sort of heat treatment and or high residual to be effective. And as an example here, monochloramine appears to be much more effective at controlling Legionella than free chlorine. We believe that's because, one, it penetrates biofilms better, and two, into the trophozoites as well, perhaps controlling the Legionella where they grow within the biofilm environment. So, to wrap up, I haven't been watching the science, sorry, I've probably passed time. I'm over. It's a tiered approach is what I'm trying to put on here, using this risk assessment model to identify where our research gaps are, and along with EPA and the Water Research Foundation and other agencies across the country and indeed internationally, we're working on trying to reduce our uncertainties in these gaps that I've mentioned to try and work out, are we going to be able to better manage water distribution systems? Indeed, I'll just put up the summary slide here. And the bottom line here is a little bit controversial. We, of course, have chlorine residuals, and we have some monitoring of coliforms being done routinely. My point is that that is insufficient, most likely, to pick up these short-duration events that we're concerned about. And we're only concerned because there's high uncertainty about their significance. We don't really know if they are important at this stage, but we believe they could be. On that, I better say thank you.